you cannot continue to limit me to the parameters of this case. I am so much more than this. And I felt confident that the book would be able to anchor me and have people see me as a person. So only when it was done, did I come out.
Chanel Miller, her memoir, Know My Name, has just been published. The book chronicles how Chanel reclaimed her name, her story, and her life after being sexually assaulted by Brock Turner, a member of the Stanford University swim team, in 2015. He faced 15 years in prison, but the judge sentenced him to just 6 months in county jail, of which he served 3 months. The judge, Aaron Persky, was later recalled by California voters. The victim impact statement Chanel Miller read during the trial went viral and was read by millions around the world. Visit democracynow.org to see Chanel reading highlights of that victim impact statement. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tay Maria Studio, and Maria Terracena, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Krug, Ishmael Gudaro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for listening to KBOO Portland, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. You are listening right now to 90.7 FM. You can also listen to KBOO at KBOO.FM all over the world anytime. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, right after these brief promotional messages.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Friday, October 11th at 6 p.m. at PSU Smith Center. Vitale directs the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project. He wrote The End of Policing. He demonstrates that the great expansion of police authority has come to exacerbate the very problems they're supposed to solve. He discusses how to counter the warrior mentality and police reliance on force and weaponry, and describes actually operating successful alternatives. But he insists that no reform will substantially succeed unless this country deals with deeply entrenched inequalities and injustice. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Friday, October 11th at 6 p.m. at PSU Smith Center, 1825 Southwest Broadway. Imagine a world beyond policing. That's no impossible dream. More information can be found on KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of LARCH Benefit Celebration on Saturday, October 19th at 5:30 p.m. at the University of Portland. LARCH Portland is a nonprofit organization that builds relationships between people with and without intellectual disabilities and promotes a community of belonging for all. The LARCH Annual Benefit Celebration features performing artists with and without disabilities, auctions, food and drink, and more. Again, that's the LARCH Benefit Celebration on Saturday, October 19th at 5:30 p.m. at the University of Portland, 5000 North Willamette Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the CEO of Mercy Corps has resigned amid an investigation citing he did not respond to reports of a former CEO sexually abusing his daughter.
In Oregon, a ban to end all in-store and online sales of flavored vaping will take place next week.
And in other news, a federal judge ruled that President Trump's use of emergency funds to build the border wall is illegal.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 11th, 2019. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. Mercy Corp's longtime CEO, Neil Kenny Geyer, resigned Thursday following an Oregonian investigation finding that the executive ignored sexual assault allegations from the daughter of Mercy Corp's co-founder, Ellsworth Culver, against her father over a decade ago. The investigation found that Culver's daughter, Tanya Culver Humphrey, reported the abuse to the Mercy Corp's board in 1992, and no action was taken. Although Culver passed away in 2005, Tanya's husband, Chris Humphrey, reported the abuse again in 2018. However, the board stood by its original assessment. There was insufficient evidence. Kenny Geyer accepted his failure in his resignation letter, writing, quote, "If I am going to morally own this and I believe in my soul, then I need to take the ultimate action." The Mercy Corp's board has started an independent external review to examine the handling of Humphrey's allegations, as well as the organization's safeguard policies and leadership accountability.
Starting October 15th, Governor Kate Brown's temporary ban on flavored vaping products will begin. The six-month temporary ban is expected to last through April 11th, 2020. Today, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission adopted Governor Brown's ban. This will make it illegal to sell the flavored vaping products in person and online in the state of Oregon. Officials announced that retailers who violate this law will be penalized $500 a day per every violation and could possibly lose their license. While the temporary ban was called to mitigate the rapid growth of national serious lung illnesses and even deaths, it will have long-term effects on local businesses. One small local retailer, Marcus Nettles, says this ban will put him out of business. Nettles also cautions that the state's decision won't stop customers from buying the products. They will instead, he says, switch to the black market. In an interview with Coin6 TV, Nettles said, quote, "You're taking people out of places, out of safe places where we have regulated products with ingredients on the bottle, and you're driving them to the black market," end quote.
As we speak, Burgerville workers are preparing to picket outside the Montevilla Burgerville as their union contract struggle continues. Workers have been attempting to negotiate a contract for over a year, and last Friday, workers delivered a full draft of a contract to Burgerville's corporate office. In meetings this week, however, the corporate team's counterproposals were deemed unacceptable. Negotiations have made some progress, but it is reportedly slow and some issues important to the union, like providing health care for transgender employees and raises for longtime workers have proved to be sticking points for the corporation. Another point of tension is that Burgerville plans to leave open the possibility of cooperating with the Department of Homeland Security when it comes to undocumented workers. The union gave Burgerville a deadline of October 18th to sign a contract, and if no deal can be reached, the union is prepared to strike.
Color Outside the Lines is a Portland nonprofit dedicated to helping foster children and other at-risk youth connect with opportunities for creativity with a focus on art and culture. This Saturday, Color Outside the Lines will be hosting a celebration of the unveiling of the Unity Project, a set of murals created by local artists and foster youth working together. KBOO's Althea Billing spoke with Color Outside the Lines founder Anna Barlow about the upcoming event.
So I understand that Saturday the 12th is going to be the unveiling of the Unity Project. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so this summer we worked on a really exciting big project. One of our focuses as a program is to do inner city murals as a collaboration with artists and the youth. And so we actually paired 24 artists with 24 foster youth this summer and fall to work one-on-one to recreate the large public art panels that are displayed on 11th and Burnside. So Noble Rot is upstairs there, and there are currently art panels on the building that have been up since 2007. So yeah, we're just excited to kind of refresh the building and the city with some bright new artwork, and each piece is really unique and has a different story. And yeah, it was just really, really amazing to watch the artists and the foster youth connect and kind of become friends.
Right, yeah. So why do you think it's so important that foster youth, or perhaps youth in general, get connected to art and creativity?
I think, you know, in years past, when I was teaching art classes with foster youth and at the Boys and Girls Club, it was just really evident that you'd really see them kind of come out of their shell, and in a way that giving them the tools to be creative and kind of giving them a direction in creating something, they had an opportunity to find a way to be expressive in ways that they didn't know that they had. And it's just, it can be incredibly healing for a lot of youth that are dealing with traumas. And it helps them to kind of refocus and do better in school and to just connect with themselves and connect with fun people. And it's just it's a really wonderful way for them to feel like they can utilize something inside of them that they maybe didn't realize was there. And it's just, yeah, I mean, there's so many studies out there to show the impacts of creativity and art are just so beneficial for all people, but especially youth that have been through challenges or griefs and traumas. So yeah, there's actually over 11,000 youth spent at least a day in foster care last year in Oregon. So we just work to give as many of these kids in the Portland area opportunities with just kind of having fun and being creative and having them be able to see what they're capable of in an artistic lens.
What is the impact that you hope the Unity Project will have?
I think that, you know, beyond really giving the city a whole nother, you know, beautiful view of fresh artwork, it's just going to be so amazing for the kids to be able to return to these pieces for years in the future. They're going to be up for the next 7 to 10 years on the building. So that's just a huge, you know, a huge accomplishment for them that really instills kind of a sense of self-worth and an excitement that they got to have an impact on the city through artwork, and also just giving the city a reminder that there's so many wonderful youth in foster care. A lot of these kids are actually up for adoption. A couple of them were actually adopted through the project after kind of being featured and things like that. And so, yeah, just kind of having people be more aware about the positive elements of supporting underprivileged youth and all youth really with arts education.
So what's the event on Saturday going to look like?
So we are super excited. It's at the Red Eco Trust building, which is on 831 Southeast Salmon. And we are going to have all of the panels there to view. So it'll be like a large art show. And then as well, we have partners with Departure, Noble Rot, Tora Bravo, Hey Love, and Five and Dime are supplying food and beverages. Pyramid Beer is supplying all the beer. And so it'll be just like a fun party that with music, and 6 to 8 will be all ages, so the kids can come and be a part of the art show. And then 8 to 11 will be 21 plus, 8 to 11:30 or so, 21 plus party. And yeah, just kind of as a way to just have people come and enjoy this beautiful art and help us to raise a little bit of money for this next year of programming. And yeah, everyone's welcome. It's open to the community.
Awesome. Is there anything else you want to impart to our listeners today?
We hope people get to cruise by the building on 11th and Burnside and check it out. They should be installed in about a month. And yeah, everyone's welcome to come to the event on Saturday from 6 to 12 at the Red at 831 Southeast Salmon.
Awesome. Well, Anna Barlow, thank you for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
Last night, Portland Democratic Socialists of America gathered outside the Moda Center to peacefully protest the Blazers playing Israeli team Maccabi Haifa. Portland Democratic Socialists of America members and volunteers handed out flyers trying to educate sports fans about the harsh restrictions and even violent discrimination placed on Palestinians from the Israeli government. KBOO's Claire Rashada went to cover the story and gained a firsthand account. As eager fans rushed to the front doors of the Moda Center, they were confronted by a large sign held by protesters reading, "Don't play apartheid." Volunteers handed out flyers while others held handmade signs reading, "End the slaughter in Gaza." All the while, a Trailblazer Moda staff member, clad in his suit, stood in the corner of the public space watching the protesters. Portland Democratic Socialists of America co-chair Olivia Cat B. Smith said, quote, "The call for boycott is to not normalize this government. They do this kind of propaganda where they come to America and say, look, we are a normal country just like you, and it really normalizes and whitewashes the brutal reality of what is going on in Palestine. And so we are asking fans not to attend the game. If they do attend the game, we hope that they look into the issue a little more and what's actually going on in Palestine and Israel."
The never-ending question, what will happen with the Wapato Jail, continues. Portland's $58 million taxpayer investment still sits unused after 15 years. Initially, it was intended to house up to 500 people seeking drug and alcohol addiction treatment. During a press conference yesterday, the current owner, Jordan Snitzer, announced that he has 18 days left on a demolition permit. In this almost three-week countdown, the pressure is on for community members and politicians to sell Snitzer a winning sales pitch. Over the past year, several nonprofits, politicians, and even hospitals have sought to take part in finally making use of the community investment. However, none were able to sell the Portland businessman with an idea that would utilize all 500 bed spaces in the building. The large property has long been sought after to house and support Portland's growing homeless population. One project after another was explored, but a plan never materialized.
The Portland Unknown Film Festival is running October 11th, 12th, and 13th at Disjecta at 8371 North Interstate Avenue. The festival aims to show examples of underground, underknown, and raw filmmaking. KBOO's Kevin Dugan spoke with the chair of the film festival, Nini and Brian Leidman, about what viewers can expect this year.
How did the film festival come about?
Well, we had wanted to have a film festival for a really long time. We actually met each other at the Fargo Theater in North Dakota.
Oh, wow.
Projectionists there as a teenager, as like college students.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of just always talked about doing this sort of stuff and wanted to. And then we finally just kind of were like, we're never going to do it if we don't just do it. And, you know, it's all about sort of like underground and like low budget. And so we were like, it's okay for us to be underground and for us to have a low budget too, you know?
Yeah.
And
we wanted to set out to do something that like even somebody who doesn't go to film festivals, they actually want to come. It's a nice mix of like art and entertainment. And yeah, 4 years later, we're doing pretty good.
Oh, wow. So underground and low budget. And you mentioned like your audience is like not necessarily, it's not just limited to people who would go to film festivals.
Yeah, there's a lot of like people who definitely have never been to a film festival who come to our festival. It's like a younger crowd in general. We like to pick also entertaining films. Even though there are like experimental things in there, we don't like theme our sessions. So there's always like something in a session that somebody's gonna really take home with them, we think.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what kind of person you are, you know.
And you mentioned like sort of underground and low budget films. Is it sort of like raising up like underrepresented or like people from marginalized backgrounds? Is there any element of that?
Yeah. So the whole like meaning of the unknown is definitely like, you know, filmmakers who are just like, you know, emerging and up and coming for sure. Like people just don't know them. Also things that are psychologically weird. But then the third thing is definitely to just like try to uplift any voice that needs to be uplifted, whether that is like women, people of color. I mean, we do choose the movies in general on like just how good they are.
Yeah.
So it's hard work. Female filmmakers is the focus of ours, but we don't really have to work very hard to do it because at least 50% of our filmmakers are female every year, and it's the same percentages with people of color and the queer community.
Exactly. It's like everybody is out there making great work. So if anybody's getting ignored, then there's something wrong.
One of our judging requirements, or not really a requirement, but something we do keep in mind, is films that have gotten into a bunch of film festivals. We usually skew away from those,
right?
You know, big ones, and we try to find people that haven't been screened a lot of places, definitely deserve to be screened a lot of places, but just for whatever reason aren't. And so we're trying to lift those people up.
That was KBOO's Kevin Dugan speaking with the chairs of the Portland Unknown Film Festival, Nini and Brian Leidman. Films will be playing throughout the weekend at Disjecta at 8371 North Interstate Avenue. More information can be found online at portlandunknown.com.
Portland-based company Vigor announces the completion of a renewable wave energy device. The industrial company built the OE-35 buoy for Ireland-based company Ocean Energy. The buoy stands 125 feet tall and has the potential rate capacity of up to 1.25 megawatts. Ocean Energy estimates that a 100-megawatt wave farm could power up to 18,750 American homes. The $12 million project was funded by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland and the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. The buoy is set to travel a 25-day journey from the coast of Oregon to the U.S. Navy Wave Energy Test Site in Kanahoe Bay, Hawaii. Ocean Energy plans to build five more buoys for deployment off the coast of Newport, Oregon.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 42 and a 0% chance of rain. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 62 and a low of 46 and a 20% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1991, Anita Hill testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee accusing now Supreme Court Judge Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. Over the years, Hill has provided commentary on gender issues, race, and civil rights. The quote of the day is from Anita Hill. She said, quote, "Testifying has helped me understand that one individual's behavior and actions make a difference, that my actions are important to people other than myself."
A federal court in Texas has ruled Trump's national emergency declaration illegal and has blocked construction of the border wall. In February, El Paso County, in partnership with the Border Network for Human Rights, filed the lawsuit against Trump's emergency declaration. The El Paso court ruled the emergency declaration violated Section 739 of the Consolidated Appropriations Act. The act prohibits funding approved by Congress to be used for any project that it was not specifically intended for, unless the change is already approved by Congress or another appropriation act is passed. The executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights, Fernando Garcia, expressed joy in the court's decision. In a statement, he said, quote, "There is no emergency at the border. This action was based on a distortion of the reality on the ground for our border communities. We, along with our partner, always knew that the use of military funds for the construction of a border wall was illegal. It's time to abandon this ridiculous idea," end quote. The plaintiffs will have 10 days to file a proposed preliminary injunction.
Both Oregon and Washington have been praised for their implementation of statewide reform of how rape kits are tracked. This week, Connecticut has achieved a milestone in reforming how rape kits are tested. Many kits are not tested in a timely manner, if at all, and a study of untested rape kits in Ohio found more than half were connected to serial offenders. Andrea Sears has more on the story.
Connecticut has enacted reforms that have significantly reduced the state's backlog of untested rape kits and will ensure the prompt processing of kits going forward. Connecticut is one of three states being recognized this month for adopting six reforms recommended for ending the nationwide problem of rape kits that often go unprocessed for years. According to Ilsa Connect with the Joyful Heart Foundation, in 2015, Connecticut had a backlog of more than 1,100 untested rape kits.
Behind every single one of these rape kits is a sexual assault survivor who has gone through this procedure to collect evidence. And when they sit on shelves, it sends a terrible message to survivors that what happened to them doesn't matter.
By 2017, all untested rape kits in the state had been transferred for testing, and Connecticut now has electronic tracking of kits, as well as policies to keep survivors informed of testing status. Connect emphasizes that processing rape kits is important not only to bring justice for survivors, but to prevent future assaults as well.
Every time a rape kit sits on the shelf, there's a potential for another person to be victimized by that offender. And all the while, the DNA to stop that person could be sitting in a box on a shelf.
By January of last year, the testing of backlogged rape kits nationwide had resulted in the identification of nearly 1,300 serial rapists. In 2016, the Joyful Heart Foundation launched a campaign to get all states to adopt its recommended reforms. Connect says, with the addition of Connecticut, Oregon, and Utah this year, the total number of states that have adopted all six rape kit reforms now stands at 12.
We are looking now at 2020. We are picking our top 10 states for next year, and we're not going to stop the campaign until we get it done.
For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Today, President Trump announced he has reached a, quote, substantial trade deal with China. The president's not-yet-finalized trade agreement comes 1 week before a rise in tariffs on China. Trump said in his announcement, this is phase one of an agreement with the Chinese government and will take weeks to write. The announcement comes after a trade war over the past year with President Trump increasing tariffs on Chinese goods. In this agreement, President Trump will not raise tariffs on Chinese goods that would have amounted to $250 billion. However, as the New York Times reports, quote, the president has not made a final decision on whether to increase tariffs further on December 15th, as he has threatened. In exchange for not raising tariffs on China, as was originally planned, the agreement includes China will contribute to America's economy by buying up to $50 billion of agriculture products. During a press conference in the Oval Office, President Trump said of the deal, quote, it's such a big deal that doing it in sections, in phases, is really big. So you'll either have two phases or three phases. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says there is still much work that remains despite this agreement.
A prominent Hong Kong legislature has warned Apple not to become an accomplice to Chinese oppression in a letter to Apple CEO Tim Cook. Apple has come under attack for its recent withdrawal of an app from the App Store that showed the location of police. Many Hong Kong protesters relied on this app to avoid rising police brutality. IT entrepreneur and lawmaker Charles Mok wrote in the letter, quote, we Hong Kongers will definitely look closer at whether Apple chooses to uphold its commitment to free expression and other basic human rights or becomes an accomplice for Chinese censorship and oppression, end quote. Tim Cook defended Apple's decision to pull HK Maps in a memo to Apple employees. He said that Apple has received, quote, credible information, end quote, from Hong Kong's Tech Crime and Cybersecurity Unit that the app was being used to target individual police officers with unwarranted violence. However, critics have pointed out Apple's heavy reliance on China for production as a market.
Many American jobs are involved with the energy sector, even though they may not look like what you think. The energy efficiency economy is growing, and even bigger gains are expected this year. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2018, almost 2.5 million Americans had jobs related to energy efficiency. That includes ENERGY STAR appliance installers, green builders, heating and cooling technicians, engineers, and more.
They are well-paid domestic jobs. They are in every town, every state, and they are jobs that are not going to go away.
Lisa Jacobson is president of the Business Council for Sustainable Energy. She says the efficiency industry continues to expand. According to the U.S. Energy and Employment Report, more than 75,000 new energy efficiency jobs were added last year, with even faster growth projected this year. Jacobson says that growth has come with a wider range of opportunities for job seekers.
The energy sector jobs are very different now. They're very integrated with computer science, and they're very systems-oriented. They require everything from engineers to installers, and there's an opportunity for everybody.
So she says it's important that young people be prepared.
I think it's really important that our education system start early and encourage all levels of interest in energy jobs.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 11th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Asia Hawthorne, Claire Ricciotto, and Kevin Dugan. Our producers are Claire Ricciotto and Asia Hawthorne, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. Stay tuned for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, one of the ways corporate media coverage of the now more than 3-week-old GM strike is like coverage of every strike is the use, so common as to be invisible, of constructions like GM strike leaves thousands of outside workers without a job. The strike may begin to drag the economy in places like Michigan. In Flint, at least 1,200 truckers and production workers from suppliers have lost their jobs because of the strike. To describe the intervention, the strike, as the cause of all attendant harms suggests that the status quo, to which the strike is a response, is blameless. Management's predations, in this case including cutting health care, using tiered wage scales and temporary workers to undercut pay and security, are daily and grinding and deeply unfair. But it's the strike that's disruptive and damaging and somehow out of bounds. We'll talk about the strike reality outside of corporate media's frame with Mike Elk, senior labor reporter and founder of Payday Report. Also on the show, California's corporate lobbyists did not want the state to pass the Public Banking Act, but a coalition of non-lobbyists, workers and climate justice and civil rights and community groups made it